If you or someone you're close to has an eating disorder, there was some good news over the weekend. Starting late next year, people with severe disorders like anorexia nervosa or bulimia will get better access to Medicare-funded treatment and be eligible for up to 60 appointments a year with psychologists and dietitians. And yes, this is good news as far as treatment goes, but scientists have also been looking further into trying to figure out why someone develops an eating disorder in the first place, and if there are ways to predict the risk so as to hopefully prevent it. We'll hear more on that from a leading researcher in just a moment, but first let's meet Elise Thompson. Hello, Elise.
Hi.
Now, you're in your late 20s, but as a teenager you lived for some years with anorexia. Can you tell me when and how it started?
Yeah, I was diagnosed when I was 12 years old.
It's young, isn't it?
Yeah, it's young. And I was unwell for about six years.
What do you know what prompted it?
I think the final trigger was my mother was diagnosed with a rare aggressive inflammatory breast cancer. You know, I had a really great childhood and nothing sort of bad had ever happened to me prior to that. And I think that combined with I was just entering high school was probably, just a lot of stress. This was my coping mechanism.
Was it a kind of way of taking some control, your food intake was a way available to you to control your life?
Yeah, definitely. I remember it started out as I decided to pack my lunch for school so that, you know, my dad would have less to do with mum being unwell. And then I just kind of packed less food and then started feeling really good. And then before I knew it, it was controlling me and I wasn't controlling.
So when you say you began feeling really good, in what way?
Feeling like I knew a secret that no one else knew, that I had figured something out that other people hadn't. There was this way to feel in control and feel like I, was doing everything in my life to make myself a better person.
Wow. When did people get concerned about you? I mean, did anyone say anything to you?
Initially, I got compliments for losing weight, as is the way in our society. But it was after I'd been unwell for about probably 9 months. My friends went to the school counsellor and she called my mother and advised her to take me to a GP.
Right. But it was another some 6 years or something that you were in the grip of this.
Yeah. So I had treatment for 2 years as an outpatient. I grew up in a rural town. Had treatment there with a psychologist and dietitian, and then was admitted to hospital a number of times in sort of later years. All up it was 6 years. Mm.
Well, Elise, stay with us, but let's now meet Tracy Wade. Psychology is her subject. She's the Matthew Flinders Distinguished Professor at Flinders University and also an associate investigator with the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative, known as ANGI. It's an international project to identify genes that contribute to anorexia nervosa. Tracy, thank you for joining us in Life Matters.
It's a pleasure.
What are the long-term health effects of an eating disorder like anorexia nervosa?
Well, if we look at anorexia nervosa in particular, we know that it has the highest mortality rate associated with it of any other mental health disorder. So it's potentially potentially fatal. So that's, I guess, at one end of the continuum. But there's a lot of disability on that continuum in that it can certainly damage bone development. So people, if they've had anorexia throughout their adolescent years when bones are developing, can have osteoporosis before they're 30. We know that it also has a big impact on the brain. It starts to shrink areas of the brain such that it starts to resemble something that you would see in Alzheimer's disease.
Gosh.
Now, that can recover with good nutrition, mm-hmm. but the osteoporosis is not able to be recovered. But also, I guess, what drew me into the area is just the loss of actually participating in life that goes on with any eating disorder, where people are withdrawing from their friends, from their family, they're trying to hide the disorder, they're ashamed, they can't eat with people. It affects their ability to work, to study, and basically it's also driven by a sense of not being good enough, sometimes a sense of self-disgust. So people are really taking themselves out of society so they can no longer participate and contribute.
Elise, does any of that ring true for you, that the social effects? Because you actually said that this was empowering for you, you know, that it was a secret you had, secret control.
Anorexia, in my experience, is not a social disorder. It does make doing anything socially really difficult, because when we get together, we go out to eat. So it's a whole lot of isolation, that, and also just being on a different wavelength to everyone else.
Well, Tracy, when it comes to the causes why someone gets an eating disorder, are there genetic links? What's been established there?
Yes, there are certainly genetic links. We started off on this road using twin studies about 20 years ago now, and comparing identical twins with non-identical twins. And there's been hundreds of studies done now around the world. And if you look at those across the number of studies, they suggest about 52% of the variance, what contributes to the development of an eating disorder, is genetic. Now, that will differ for each individual. They'll run up and down a scale, you know, anywhere around that figure. And also, it's not just one gene. There's no complex disorder that is created by one gene.
No, the gene for anorexia, for example.
No. Mm. So I'm keen that people understand we're not going to detect the one gene. Now, we're starting to catch up with our genetic studies in terms of the DNA. And last year, the first study came out, which actually identified about 5 different genes which increase risk for anorexia nervosa. These studies have taken a long time to pull together, because you need at least 10,000 people with the disorder, and then compare them to people that don't have the disorder. And there's another study coming out next year which identifies another 5 or so genes as well. So we've just started on that road to actually being able to be specific in identifying the genetic variants that contribute risk to anorexia nervosa.
And this is work that you're doing that's being done by the Anorexia Nervosa Genetics Initiative that I mentioned, Angie, this international study you're part of?
Yeah, that's correct. It's been across 5 countries, and the leader is Professor Cindy Bulick in the US. And all genetic studies these days are multi-site, multi-country. They need to be in order to start to get results. So it's a remarkably collaborative area. And the Angie results will be coming out next year. And now we're morphing into EDGY, which is the Eating Disorders Genetics Initiative.
Okay, so broadening it out from anorexia nervosa to other eating disorders.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Mm. Tracy, you're also working on developing a polygenic risk test. Is that right? What is this?
Yes, it's a newish development in the field. It's been applied to schizophrenia, but we're starting to become more and more aware of the complexity of genes and how they interact with the environment. And so we understand now that there are hundreds of genes that predispose risk to these different disorders. So the polygenic risk score actually, develops a score which is calculated across the different genetic variants and will place people at risk on a scale in terms of increasing risk or lower risk for particular disorders. So we have followed through a cohort of Australian teenagers, females, for about 3 years. We followed them through from early adolescence through to late adolescence. And we found that about 15% of those girls had an eating disorder over the time that we talked to them. We did quite in-depth interviews about their eating. And some of those recovered and moved on, some have not. But we have very detailed information about the types of eating disorders, the age they developed them, and we've got blood samples from a lot of those people that have just been genotyped in the Netherlands. So along with my colleague, Dr. Sarah Cohen from Flinders University, who's an epigeneticist, we are looking to develop this polygenic risk score for disordered eating.
And Tracy, what are the implications of this? What do you hope all this will lead to?
Well, what we hope is that it actually will allow us to indicate heightened risk using a blood test. That's in the future. And because we know that a genetic susceptibility does not mean predetermination, it doesn't mean that you'll definitely get the eating disorder. What it then can alert people to is the fact that they need to build up a protective environment, just like
yes,
if diabetes runs in the family.
Yeah,
it's a predisposition. And so it's looking at building in a protective environment. And it might be that you already have concerns about your child in that there are eating disorders in the family, or they're a bit perfectionistic or obsessional, or perhaps they're experiencing peer teasing about appearance. So it might be that the parents then decide to follow up with that blood test. And we know that there are protective environments for eating disorders. We certainly recommend people, for example, not going on diets because they very quickly become obsessional. And I think Elise gave a little bit of a feel for that. We also know some research that was done in the US suggests that actually having dinner together each night as a family is really protective. And we think that works because it helps build up problem-solving abilities. The conversation around the family table is something that allows the child to just process what's happened during the day, to work through the stress and to manage that. And often in busy families, sometimes eating together is something that can get lost.
Which also means that the person with the eating disorder can hide it more easily if the family's
That's right,
not eating together.
Yeah, they often talk about starting to eat in their bedroom and that becomes normalised. And there's also, you know, the issue that Elise talked about, which is that reinforcement when kids start dieting. Often families are very positive, and because we have this sort of, as society now, we have this great horror of obesity and everyone becoming fat. And so families are often quite encouraging. Certainly they get a lot of social reinforcement for losing weight. And so it does involve a bit of a rethinking in style. And we also have good skills training groups now that we do with parents to teach them the skills to work with their child, because it's not an easy thing to understand when your child just doesn't want to eat. We're not really prepared for that type of response.
Mm. Well, Elise Thompson, what are your thoughts on this, you know, a genetic test, a blood test for eating disorders like anorexia? Do you think this could help others with what you went through, avoid what you went through as a teenager, I suppose?
Yeah, definitely. I think even if just knowing that there is a heightened risk there would mean that, yeah, like Tracy said, there could be a prevention of or more of a concern when an adolescent starts, you know, because I phrased it when I was unwell as just wanting to be healthier and just wanting to eat more healthy, which is a good thing. That was around the time of the whole childhood obesity epidemic stuff coming out. And so
what, that was the spin, the good spin you put on it?
Yeah, definitely. I just wanted to look after my health and I was doing this really good thing.
And except you weren't.
Yeah, I couldn't understand when everyone got so anxious and worked up about it. So I think, yeah, in terms of just knowing risk, that would be hugely beneficial.
And at least just looking back on that time for you, just tell me more about how you feel having that eating disorder affected your life.
The main thing that I think now, looking back on it, is that I missed out on my adolescence. Like, you know, now when people talk about how in high school they went to parties or they, you know, got boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever, I kind of don't have a lot to contribute to that because my adolescence was, you know, in hospital or at home or worrying about what I was eating or not eating. So that was a huge, and when I recovered, that was sort of a huge catch-up period as well. I went through kind of a lot of delayed adolescent milestones as I recovered, which was lovely to experience ultimately.
Mature age adolescence.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah. It was, yeah, kind of delayed.
Well, Tracy, for Elise, I mean, it took a lot of treatment over a number of years for her to finally get herself out of the grips of her eating disorder. What are the key developments now in treating someone who does have, before we've got this, you know, better prevention mechanism, for someone who does have an eating disorder now, what are the sort of, what's the latest in treatments?
Yeah, I think the evidence suggests that one of the key ideas is early intervention. Don't have a wait and watch, it's just a phase, they'll grow out of it sort of approach to this. Because particularly in adolescence, it just takes a few months to turn into something then that is in control of the child, and they can really no longer turn it around on their own. So that early intervention is incredibly important. Taking them to a professional who has expertise in eating disorders is also important rather than a generalist. It is a very tricky and complex area, and there certainly are a number of professionals out there, and different organisations can advise as to who best to approach. It also should build in good medical monitoring, because again, it means that people can get unwell very quickly, particularly adolescents, and so it does need that regular medical monitoring. And it can involve a certain intensity of treatment. It isn't just going to be the same treatment at times, and it's certainly better to look at how the person's tracking, and if they're not making early changes, then adding more intensity is certainly recommended rather than waiting to see if the treatment takes hold. We know that early response predicts much better outcome. If that's not happening, then you need to look again at the treatment regime.
Tracy, you were at the event where the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, announced new Medicare subsidies for anyone diagnosed with severe eating disorders. Is this something you've been, well, I imagine it is something you've been hoping to see?
Yes, we've been very keen to see this, because the 10 sessions that was on the table is really insufficient for a lot of eating disorders. Not for all, but certainly for a lot of them.
And now it's more like 60 each year, yeah?
Yes, it's more like 60, and you've got the dietetics and the psychological input, recognising that this is, again, eating disorders can't just be treated by one profession. It is going to be a multidisciplinary exercise as well. And so I think a lot of the excitement on the day was really about the fact that people are recognising the gravity of eating disorders. We have felt rather marginalised over many years, including within mental health, when people
At
talk
least
about
you're,
mental
you're
illnesses.
You're nodding your head with
yeah.
that too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
You agree that this is going to make a big yeah. difference?
Yeah, I think it's a great... it just shows that the government and people are finally realising that eating disorders are so complex and not something that, you know, responds to 10 sessions of treatment per year.
Well, Elise Thompson lived with anorexia for 6 years as a teenager. She's since recovered. She's now a child psychologist. It's lovely to meet you, Elise. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Tracy Wade is an internationally renowned expert on eating disorders, and Matthew Flinders, distinguished professor at Flinders University. And it's such important and interesting research you're doing in this field, Tracy. Many thanks for filling us in on it.
Thank you for your time.